You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
coin for coin. Wait on nine. The halls like diamonds. Bells on.
7 seconds, may we use. So you say there's a race of men in the trees. Your buttons, legislation, thanks for calling. Wait all night for calls like.
Check, 1, 2, check, 1, 2, check. One, two, check, check, 1, 2. 1, 2, check. Check, 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 1, 2. everyone. I just thought I would let you know that we will be beginning presently. We are set up and ready to roll here in the Student Union Building of the West Virginia State University and Institute West Virginia. The Seneca 2 Forum will be coming your way this evening, featuring ConsortiumNews.com's Robert Perry and Ray McGovern. I believe you will find this quite interesting. We will also be starting the video shortly at ustream.tv. There is a direct link to the Horn channel at headonradionetwork.com. Also, an apology on my part. Because of the nature of the network here at West Virginia State, I can't get into the chat room. So sorry about that. But, hey, it's going. And stand by. I think you're going to enjoy all of this. Right here, only on the Horn, America's listener-supported liberal voice.
Agency sent a science department to yet another storm. Thank you for coming.
Before we start, it has been called to my attention that Virginia Grant is in our audience. Virginia is running for Congress in the 2nd Congressional District against Shelley Moore Capito. And I would like for Virginia to stand up so we could recognize her and talk with her and have a time to visit with her this evening, if you have time. Are there any other candidates whom we should recognize? They should be here. Dr. Jerry Beller, Chair of the Political Science Department, would like to welcome you also. Jerry? Thanks, Jerry. Seneca 2 works very hard to bring the unreported real news to our valley. Tonight we have two of the rarest of breeds, truth tellers from Washington. Right, exactly. Ray McGovern is having a return visit with us. He's a 27-year veteran of the CIA, serving under seven presidents, presenting the morning intelligence briefings at the White House for many of them. But Ray gained fame in 2006 for his impromptu live debate with Donald Rumsfeld about the lies that were used to justify the Iraq War. That deserves a round of applause. His sidekick, Robert Perry, has covered Washington for more than 30 years, if you can believe it. He's worked for news organizations like Newsweek and the Associated Press. He led the way to exposing the Iran-Contra scandal, and he broke stories on Contra cocaine trafficking, the Rockgate scandal, and the October surprise. These men know their business, and they know Washington. Please welcome that truth-telling team, Bob and Rick.
So if I really screw up, Ray will straighten it out before.
I'll correct it.
Well, thanks for coming out on this this sort of wintry night. We just drove in from Arlington, Virginia, and I want to thank Seneca too for having us. It's a great honor to be here, and it's a great honor to try to be in touch with people that Americans who are facing the kind of challenges we all face these days. And we want to hear from you as well. The point of the Bob and Ray Show 2, as we call it, since there was an earlier version that was sort of a famous comedy team in New York. We're not going to be nearly as funny, but we do want to hear from you. And part of the idea of this was to not just for us to come out to talk to people around the country, but for us to get a sense of what Americans care about and what they're thinking about. And how they view Washington. And also, we're obviously trying to build support for our news website, consortiumnews.com, which we founded. I helped found back in 1995 as it was the first investigative website, news magazine sort of thing on the Internet, because back then there wasn't much on the Internet. So we've kept that going. So this is an effort to sort of reach out to Americans, hear what you have to say, and explain some of our perspectives to you folks. So it might be a good idea to start with a bit more about my background. I was a I'm what's called a mainstream journalist, at least I was for quite a few years. Started with the Associated Press, which is, of course, the National Wire Service. And I've been in Washington since 1977. I've also was involved in some of the early reporting that led to what's known as the Iran-Contra scandal. I did the first story about this curious White House aide named Oliver North, and he was running a secret war in Central America at the time. I went on from there to work after finally that scandal was finally broken more wide open to prepare Newsweek, and I've done work for PBS Frontline and also for Bloomberg News as an editor there. But I think it's useful to sort of start real quickly back at a different time in America when in the late 1960s and early 1970s, there's a documentary that just came out, which is worth seeing if you get a chance, entitled The Most Dangerous Man in America. It's the story of Dan Ellsberg. And Ray and I were lucky enough to actually see it a couple times with Ellsberg there in D.C. So he could respond to questions about it. But that was a point when the American people were very engaged because the Vietnam War kind of forced us to be very engaged. There was also an effort by people like Ellsberg to get information out from inside the government. Ellsberg was an insider. He was an architect of the Vietnam War, and he turned against it, and ultimately he leaked what was known as the Pentagon Papers. That was the secret history of the Vietnam War. And he gave it first to the New York Times, and they, after a while, decided they better print it, and they published it. And then when the Nixon administration tried to shut that down, he leaked it to the Washington Post and then to the Boston Globe. And ultimately, a number of newspapers took a part in getting this important chapter, these important chapters of American history to the American people. So that was a way, that it sort of reflected a different time. In many ways, the Pentagon Papers story then led Nixon to try to crack down with a group called the Plumbers, and that led to the Watergate scandal, where Nixon started spying on the Democrats. And the Washington Post stepped in that period, and they reported on those abuses. And after time, the New York Times hired people like Cy Hirsch, who had been sort of working outside the mainstream at that point. He worked at something called Dispatch News, which was a wire service that had been set up to expose things like the My Lai massacre. So you had this sort of energetic period when the Washington Press Corps was more or less doing its job. The American people were pretty much engaged because of after the Vietnam period. And then what we saw was really an effort by the Republicans and the right, primarily because they felt they had been sort of victimized by some of this, to push back. And they began building their own institutions, their own media organizations, and they set up groups to go after mainstream journalists. And as we go through that 1980s period, when I was starting to do some of my reporting, we became, in the mainstream press, much more under attack. There was a lot of pressure put on us to not tell those kinds of stories. And it became harder and harder over those years to do so. And the Reagan administration was very effective in shaping the message. And they rallied a lot of Americans, even working class Americans, to positions that were more favorable to the conservative side. You had what were called Reagan Democrats, people who were like working class people who had been Democrats because of the unions and because they'd seen FDR lift them out of poverty into a better situation. They began to be swung over. And over time, this continued. And as we go through the late 80s and early 90s, it became harder and harder for those of us in the mainstream press to tell those kinds of stories. And we can go into some, if you'd like, in the question and answer time. But suffice it to say that we reached a point where we weren't doing our jobs at all very well. And I left Newsweek after a lot of battles inside that company in 1990. And tried working for PBS and writing some books. And then, because things had reached such a level, even though we had a great deal of important information to get out, I was able to get hold of a number of secret and top secret documents on a very important part of our history of how the Reagan era began, but no one really was interested. So in 1995, I was at home complaining about this, and my oldest son, Sam, had just gotten out of college. And he said, "Dad, you know, instead of complaining, you know, there is something called the Internet, you know. You could start something called a website, And I said, you know, I wasn't quite sure if it'd be like the new 8-track tape kind of idea, that one of those fatty technologies that would just sort of disappear soon. But I said, okay, well, I guess we could do that. And so Sam, who had no real experience in this, kind of built a website. Back then there were no templates. You had to sort of really just build it. And it looked a bit like that. We were a bit homemade. We still are a little bit homemade. But anyway, we started putting out our stories directly to the American people. But we tried to maintain the sort of the integrity of the journalistic standards that I was taught at AP and places like that. And so we've moved on, and over time we've struggled to get a lot of good stories out. And one of the interesting things that's happened during this period, especially when you get to the Bush 2 era, was that what I discovered was that there was a parallel thing that had been going on inside the Central Intelligence Agency. And people don't quite, I mean, I think people have a view of the CIA, which can be a little bit shaped by what they see in movies, and certainly they can be very suspicious of some things in the CIA. But the CIA is basically divided into two parts. There's the so-called operations side, where they go, they spy, and they might do dirty tricks, and they might try to overthrow governments, stuff like that. And then there's the analytical side. And that was set up, you know, as Ray will tell you, from when Harry Truman didn't want another Pearl Harbor, when he wanted to have all the information in one place, so the president and the top government officials could make the right decisions. And so he set up the analytical division of CIA as a way to have that ethos of just telling the truth. And I must say, and Ray might go into this too, there was kind of a perverse joy these guys would have, and I've gotten to know a number of them over the years. They liked to tell the president that he was full of it. You know, the president was just some politician who'd come into town for a while. They were here for this long haul, and they were like scholars. They were people that really like knew stuff. They spoke Russian. I mean, Ray speaks Russian. And so they actually would follow these things. And so when the president politically, whether it was Democrat or Republican, they would tell Eisenhower there's no bomber gap. They would tell Kennedy there's no missile gap. They would tell LBJ that, you know, that bombing of North Vietnam's not working. And they kind of took a perverse pleasure in doing it. And that also was a problem, though, because at some point when we were starting to see this change in the attitude toward information in that period of the early 1980s, there was a group, a very smart group of my name would call them Mandarins. They were like very smart bureaucrats. We now call them the neoconservatives. And they felt that they could control the information flows through Washington, both with the press and at the CIA's analytical division. They could really control what Americans get to see and hear and what the political leaders get to see and hear. So they made a real effort to corrupt the CIA's analytical division, just as they were putting pressure on the mainstream press not to tell you some of these unpleasant stories that we sort of have to, we should tell you sometimes. They were putting pressure on the CIA analytical division not to report accurately about things. And the reason is obvious. If you can exaggerate dangers, that can direct policy. And if you can make the Soviet Union seem more dangerous than it was, say, in the 1980s, then that means more money for Pentagon contractors. If you get to this period of the last decade, if you can exaggerate the dangers of Iraq and Saddam Hussein, that might mean the American people will support a war that they might otherwise think is a bad idea. So controlling information is really a key point in how people in Washington have thought about how to control you. And many Americans thought they had the press to act as their watchdog, to sort of keep an eye on things. But as I'm sure many of you know, we haven't been doing a very good job recently. In fact, many of the main news organizations now routinely miss stories or present one side of a story. We're seeing this, we saw this with Iraq. And it wasn't just the right-wing press that did Iraq wrong. It was the New York Times and the Washington Post, what is often called the liberal media, but they're not really that liberal, but they presented a lot of exaggerated propaganda. So, you know, the role that we've tried to play in our small way at consortiumnews.com is to challenge those things and to pull together. One of the pleasures of doing what we did was that people like Ray and other CIA analysts who were as fed up with what was happening to their profession as I was fed up with what was happening to mine, we sort of come together and we write these stories that that try to explain with context and history and detail and we hope very careful analysis of the facts what's going on. Anyway, so that's what we've tried to do, and maybe Ray wants to give you a little fill-in about what it was like to be on his side of that wall in terms of his efforts. And as you may know, Ray was not only was he in the CIA for a long time, but then he did community work. And he formed a group called the Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, which sort of, I guess the title sort of tells you a lot. But Ray formed this with the idea, with other professionals in this intelligence analysts who were watching this effort to mislead the American people into a war. And so in 2002, they began, rather sweetly, trying to persuade George W. Bush that he was getting bad information from the CIA, I guess not fully knowing that that's what he wanted to get. But anyway, I want to turn it over to Ray so we can fill you in on the rest of it, then we can open up to questions.
Well, it's great to be back here. I remember this room very well, and I see some familiar faces. I was a couple minutes late, and I probably should explain why. I was listening on the news about Osama bin Laden confessing and being forgiven and going up to meet St. Peter in heaven this afternoon. Did any of you hear that on the ABC? No? Yeah. He came to the embassy in Kabul and really confessed and said he was really sorry. He was forgiven by Ambassador Eikenberry and immediately had a heart attack and ended up climbing the hill up to heaven. And St. Peter was, you know, cleaning up after a long day, you know, kind of Tuesday. Yeah. And he sees this fellow coming up the hill, long flowing white robes. And he said, "My God, that looks like Osama bin Laden." Now, thankfully, St. Peter always goes by the book, right? So he went over to his book, and there was a late entry. It said, "Yes, Osama bin Laden has confessed and forgiven heart attack. Welcome him with open arms into heaven." And so he said, "Osama bin Laden?
Yeah.
Well, come on into this alcove. I want to show you. I want you to meet some people. You're most welcome. Welcome to heaven." He goes through the alcove. There's George Washington over there. There's James Madison. Tom Jefferson. Patrick Henry. Osama bin Laden. Which translated from the Arabic means, "Where are my virgins?" And St. Peter says, "Oh, I'm awfully sorry about that garble. It wasn't virgins, it was Virginians. West Virginians." Okay, now my colleague Bob has told you about the perverse delight I take in things. As you can see, I take perverse delight in telling bad jokes. At least on this trip, Bob and I were just in Los Angeles, and we're traveling around there. It's a terrible place to travel around. And so we hired one of these women that sits inside one of these GPS things and tells you what to do. Yeah, we were spared that today, thank God, because we had better guidance. But that woman was downright condescending. You know, how many times, Bob, did you say,
"Recalculating"?
Yeah, it was good that was on mute because you didn't hear that last part. Well, listen, it really is good to be back here. Bob has mentioned Dan Ellsberg, who's one of my heroes. You know, he was one of the guys that at great personal risk, risked everything, including his freedom. At one point, they had so many charges against him for leaking the Pentagon Papers, which showed what a travesty the war in Vietnam was. They had him up to 120 years in jail that he was going to be convicted of. That's kind of a long story. But what I want to mention is that Bob and I saw Dan twice, as Bob said, in Washington. And then when I heard that Dan was going to be appearing at the theater in Berkeley, not West Virginia, but out there in California near San Francisco, I was visiting my daughter there over the weekend. So on
Sunday night, I saw it a third time. The most dangerous man in America. Don't miss it, folks. If you want to be uplifted, if you want to see what one person can do by doing the right thing, it's really true. One person can make a difference. So anyhow, as we were walking in the theater, there's Dan. So I greeted him and his wife Patricia were there. It was really good to see her again. She has a starring role in the film, by the way, which is up for an Academy Award. So if that may be one reason to watch Academy Awards. Now, Dan he had this manila folder with him. And he looks at me, he says, "Ray, look what I have in my manila folder." And I looked in there. It was about 18 articles downloaded and printed off from consortiumnews.com. He says, "Make sure you tell Bob." I said, "What are you doing with those?" He said, "Well, I thought that while other people were watching the performance here, I could sit down and kind of get up on things. This is the way I keep up on things." I said, "Wow, you know? You get out of the beltway and you see that people actually tune in, read it, and share it. And important people like Dan Ellsberg, well, that speaks volumes. Now, how bad is it with the press these days? Well, let me give you just one little vignette. In 2001, before 9/11, in May came the 30th anniversary of the publication of the Pentagon Papers, okay? And lots of us who were involved in those days, whether it was from the intelligence services or the State Department or the Pentagon or the press and academe, there were about 50 of us convened at the National Press Club to celebrate, okay? And Dan came, Dan Ellsberg gave a little talk. And then it was pointed out they had four New York Times officials there and four senior Washington Post officials, and they were going to talk a little bit about it, too. Some of them had been around during those days when those gutsy decisions were made against risking a presidential injunction, the first and only of its kind, against prior restraint of publishing these things. They took a lot of risks, so there was a lot of black slapping, and Dan was feeling good. Everybody was feeling good. It's one lady. It's usually a lady that asks the gutsy question. She's sitting in the back, and she says, "My gentleman," and of course they were all gentlemen, you know, 30 years ago, only gentlemen, so-called, got up to those pretty high places. She said, "Gentlemen, suppose someone leaked the equivalent of the Pentagon Papers today. Would your papers, the Washington Post, New York Times, would they publish them?" That's how quiet it was, folks. That's how quiet it was for, it seemed like 2 minutes, probably was about 30 seconds. You could hear a pin drop. And then Hedrick Smith, who was no longer with the Times, the only one that wasn't actively employed at that time, he sort of clears his throat and he says, I don't know. I don't know about today. He played a crucial role 30 years previous. I don't know. I don't. Next guy, no, probably not. They go down with these four New York Times people, four Washington Post. By the time they get to the end, they say, No way would we publish that today. And I'm looking at this, and I'm thinking, my God, here it is. Four people, three actively employed by the New York Times, four at senior levels in the Washington Post with every incentive to brag about the courage of their newspapers, are saying to me and to everybody else, "No, probably not today." And you know what? There wasn't a trace of embarrassment. There wasn't a trace of discomfort. It's just the way it is today. And I said to myself, my goodness, isn't it all hanging right out there? And so that's what Bob's talking about. Honest journalists don't last long if they tell the truth. And in the prelude to Iraq, you saw that. You saw the New York Times, Washington Post, all the media outlets. That's why I call it the fawning corporate media, FCM. They're all, you know, they're driven not by a search for the truth, as Bob and I try to be, but a search for profits and whatnot. So as a little footnote on the Pentagon Papers, there was one revealing item in the documentary, which I only caught the third time. I'm Irish and I'm a little thick, so it takes me three times to see a film, especially with my wife not with me to explain what's going on, you know. So this third time I noticed that the head lawyer for the New York Times, the private counsel, the head senior counsel, was explaining why he thought that the Times really needed to publish this. As Bob suggested, the Times diddled and daddled and, oh, gee, I don't know, this is classified, should we publish it? And, you know, what would be our legal liability and all that stuff? Well, this fellow said, yeah, I think you ought to go ahead, against the counsel of their outside law firms that work for the Times. And in the picture, he brags about the courageousness, but then he lets the cat out of the bag. He said, in the end, the New York Times just couldn't possibly risk the possibility that people would learn that they had all these incredible documents that bore directly on this feckless war and suppressed them. Isn't that interesting? That it wasn't so much the First Amendment in his view, this lawyer, but rather the PR catastrophe that would happen if people learned, whoops, Dan Ellsberg gave all these documents and the New York Times suppressed them. Now let me tell you about a more recent time when the New York Times suppressed something. James Risen, prominent New York Times writer, wrote a book. And in that book he revealed that Dick Cheney, George Bush, and the others deliberately violated the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act many times by this illegal eavesdropping. The law says you're not supposed to eavesdrop on an American citizen without a court warrant. Well, warrant terror? You know, doesn't matter. We just go ahead and do it. Well, Risen was on to this, and he was on to this before the election in 2004. Months before. He sat on it. The New York Times sat on it, yeah. Well, you know, I hold a person like that, you know, maybe you and I differ on that, but you know, if I were Risen, I would have, even if the New York Times didn't want it, I would have blown a whistle on that. That was so egregious. Anyhow, the New York Times didn't publish it. Bush won the election. Now, I'm not sure that would have changed the election, but I think it might have had a big effect on a lot of people if they knew that their telephones, their emails, their faxes and everything being tapped without a court warrant. I mean, against the law. Clearly against the law. Felony, okay? So the New York Times sat on it. And only in the following December, so not December 04, but December 05, when Risen's book was finally in galley and he's getting all ready to produce it, the head of New York Times, Sulzberger, I guess, the head came down from New York and he said, oh, my God, this is going to be embarrassing because if the American people learn first about this from a book by one of our journalists and we haven't told the story in the New York Times, that's going to be very embarrassing. So they came, and Bush received them in the Oval Office, the Washington bureau chief and the chief editor. And he tried as hard as he could to persuade them not to publish this. But they said, look, it's just too embarrassing. We're going to go ahead. And several days later, they did publish it. So there you go. I mean, these people are playing ball with the authorities, and it keeps happening and keeps happening and keeps happening. So what's needed is a place where people can go. And, you know, it's not real hard. Consortium News, for example, we do maybe 2, 3, 4 items a day tops. And you can get an email. And if you don't like the topics or the issues, you know, this has always that delete button. But if you like one, well, you just hit the live link, and there it is. You leave the read the first paragraph, second, you know, you can do what you want with it. So it's a way of getting really informed. And I would suggest that it's really the only way, because the whole media, the electronic, the cable TV, the network TVs, very rarely do you get good coverage, save MSNBC, which has made some strides in the recent years. What else do I want to say? Well, a recent example of this problem came up with respect to Iran. And this is really recent. This is, I guess, last Thursday. The new head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, issued a report about Iran. And, you know, it's not long, it's just 10 pages. I could download it, and I did, and I read it. And then I saw the New York Times write up about it, and they're saying, ah, the UN agency, the IAEA, has determined that contrary to what the U.S. intelligence community is saying, Iranians are continuing work on a nuclear weapon. Now, everyone knows that the Iranians are working on enriching uranium for a nuclear capability. The big question is whether they're ready to weaponize that, whether they're working on a nuclear warhead. And in 2007, November, the 16 intelligence agencies, one of which I used to work for, got together and did a bottom-up assessment of where Iran was on its nuclear weapons development program. And the main conclusion was this, issued with high confidence, okay, that indeed Iran had a secret nuclear weapons development program up until the fall of 2003, but then they stopped. They stopped it. We have really good information. They cut it out. They stopped it, okay? And at the time of the written estimate, mid-2007, they had not resumed it. And they didn't know whether they would resume it or not. And the bottom line judgment was, whereas it seems that the Iranians are keeping their options open, clearly they haven't decided yet whether they're going to go for a nuclear weapon. Okay? So that's 2007, December. What did George Bush do? In January, he flies over to Tel Aviv, and he says, yeah, I know about that estimate, but I don't agree with it. I have a different view. Hello? He had a different view. There was a juggernaut rolling toward war with Iran at that time, okay, beginning of 08. Cheney and Bush were stoking the fires, and this estimate took the wind out of those sails. It really spiked that effort, together with a couple other things. Now, how do we know about the estimate? That's an interesting story. We know about it mostly because the senior military who know what a catastrophe it would be to attack Iran. I mean, talk about crazy things. They were doing everything they could to rein in Cheney and Elliot Abrams and the neocons so that they wouldn't give orders to the military to do this. And when they heard about the estimate, they insisted. They insisted that it be made public, that the key judgments be made public. Can you imagine the military trying to prevent, you know, a catastrophic military activity, going to the agency and overruling the head of national intelligence and insisting that this thing be published? So that did it in. Okay, so where are we now? Well, Admiral Blair, he's called the Director of National Intelligence, he's the super guy over all these 16 agencies, he testified to Congress to the Senate Intelligence Committee on the 2nd of February and said, our judgments stand, that we don't know whether the Iranians have decided one way or another. There's no evidence that they have, and they're keeping their options open. And so that's, you know, what, earlier this month. Then the IAEA guy comes out. Okay, he's the new head of the IAEA. He takes the place of a fellow named El Baradei from Egypt who had guts to spare. He was the guy that got before the UN and said, hey, you've all heard that cockamamie story about Iraq seeking yellow cake uranium in Niger, as he put it diplomatically. This is not authentic. It was based on forgeries. Forgeries. Now, who did the forgeries? Well, Jay Rockefeller, to his credit, went to the fellow from Kansas who was the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Pat Roberts, and said, you know, this is really noxious. A lot of congressmen and senators voted for this war because they thought that Iraq was seeking uranium in Niger. Let's investigate this. We ought to put the FBI, find out how this happened. And Pat Roberts said, no, I don't think so. No, we're going to have to do that. And Jay Rockefeller said, oh, okay. Actually, he did better than that. He did write a letter to the... He wrote a letter saying we should to the head of the FBI, and the head of the FBI said, "Who's this letter from?" Oh, the ranking member, not the chair of this committee, and so the FBI completely neglected it. So that's the kind of thing that's out there, and that's the kind of thing that the New York Times jumps on, because in this very ambiguous 10 pages, this new head of the IAEA says that it's possible that some of these activities, some of this evidence, suggests that the Iranians are working on a nuclear warhead part of their program into and after 2004, okay? Now, what do I think about that? I don't think much about that. It's impossible, in my ken, that Admiral Blair, who said on the 2nd of February that was not so, it's impossible that he didn't know all this new evidence. There is no new evidence. You know where the evidence comes from? Who knows what the Mossad is? That's the Israeli intelligence agency. It comes from people like Chalabi, defectors and stuff like that. It comes from Iranian claims to have enriched to 20%, okay? Well, the president's spokesman, Gibbs, says that's crazy. We know that they don't have the capability. So you have this complete contradiction. No wonder we're all confused, huh? Who do you believe? So that's why it's really, really essential that we have the capability to speak truth to power and to spread truth among folks like you. I keep telling university audiences that they have a leg up on this because they know their way around the internet really well. But for those of you as old as I or almost as old as I, it's really a piece of cake. You know, have your kids or your grandchildren, in my case, instruct you for half an hour, and you got it. And get plugged into consortiumnews.com. Get plugged into democracynow.org. Is Amy Goodman heard here? Yeah. Well, I want to tell you something. She's not? Okay. Who knows how to hear Amy Goodman, please? Could you speak up so I can hear you?
Dish Network TV, channel 9415 and 9410.
Uh-huh.
Four times a day.
Four times a day. Wow, okay. Yeah. So in other words, you don't need to listen. You can, it's amazing. They get that transcript up within an hour. I have to tell you that when I am at home and I'm not having any early morning appointments, I set my alarm for 5 minutes to 8. That gives me just about enough time to really wake up. I tune into Amy, and for the first 10 minutes, I find out what's going on in the world. Stuff I won't find in the Washington Post or the New York Times. And then for the next 50 minutes, I'm treated to Howard Zinn. I'm treated to all kinds of interesting people like Bob Perry. So if you take the steps necessary to do that, you become informed, and then you can tell your friends. I think probably that would be enough for me. I think one of the things we need to look into here as we talk about all this is not only the press bias in favor of the owners, the corporate owners, but also the press bias in favor of Israel. It's a very strong bias. It's part and parcel of the bias in Congress. We need to know, you know, what that is and what that means and how that happens. And I'll finish up with just one small anecdote. And this comes from General Brent Scowcroft, who is one of the most widely respected national security advisors. He was under Nixon and Ford and Reagan and did lots of stuff and knows a lot about strategic things. Well, George W. Bush made the mistake of appointing Brent Scowcroft to be chair of what was then called the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. These were heavy hitters. These are people who have been around. These are people who had access to all manner of very sensitive information. And they monitored how the agencies were doing and so forth. Well, about a month before he quit or was told to go, he told the Financial Times, Ariel Sharon, the Prime Minister of Israel at the time, has our president wrapped around his little finger. He has our president mesmerized. Oh, Fred Scowcroft. Well, he was told never to darken the White House door again, and he left. But this is not a guy that's going to make an idle comment like that. What was he trying to tell us? He was trying to tell us that the influence that this small country exerts over our formation of foreign policy is not only inordinate, but it's noxious both to the United States and to the State of Israel, because things cannot continue to go along the path. I care a lot about Israel. And, you know, I care about them coming to the understanding that violence is not going to solve every problem, that the Goldstone Report should be honored, should be heeded, and they should launch a real investigation into what happened when, 1,400 Gazans were killed at the December and January of 2009, against, 14 Israelis or something like that. Talk about disproportionate. So I just leave you with the thought that this is a real question that we as adults should be able to discuss without people charging us of this or that. And unless we discuss it, our policies are going to be slanted in a way that really, really doesn't help us, because the neocons, the people that got us into Iraq, and now are trying to get us into Iran, frankly, they have great difficulty distinguishing between what they perceive to be the strategic interests of Israel on the one hand and the strategic interests of America on the other hand. Some of them are dual nationals. And, you know, I don't begrudge them. I don't begrudge them, you know, their love for Israel. I love Ireland, okay? But if during the 70s, and this occurred to me at the time, I was a pretty senior analyst during the 70s already, and then when the flap in Ireland and the North and, you know, the IRA, and they were really going at it in Derry and elsewhere, I said to myself, wow, if the head of the intelligence agency came down and said, McGovern, we want you to work on the situation, British policy toward Northern Ireland, I'd have to say, I'm sorry, no way can I do that. What do you mean? Well, with all the stories that my grandmother told me about how the English came in and what they did to my... I couldn't possibly do an object. Please, put me on Madagascar. I couldn't do a job on this. And when I came into the agency, this is the last thing I'll say, I was really, this was during John F. Kennedy. And I was in the Soviet foreign policy branch, and so I had a lot to do with the Middle East, the policy toward the Middle East. And I noticed that down in the Middle Eastern branch, the Arab Israeli branch, there are no people of Jewish extraction. There were no people of Arab extraction. That seemed odd to me. I mean, there weren't too many analysts of Arab extraction anyway, but there were lots of Jewish people. And so after I got my gumption up, I inquired. I said, well, this is really strange. Is this deliberate? And I was taken aside. Yes, this is deliberate. And, you know, I'm an American. I mean, that's... You can't do that. You can't discriminate like that, you know. That's, you know, you can't do that. Well, he did, okay? And it helped us, folks. It helped us to keep an objective view on what was going on and to preach, to tell truth to power. Now, over the last couple of years, most of the people working in the Arab-Israeli branch are of Jewish extraction, and the people that are briefed by the CIA are the pro-Israel think tanks in town and not the others. So that's another thing that we need to kind of be aware of, you know. It's not prejudice in any way to say there may be a cant here, there may be a slant that we need to face up to and recognize and work against, but that is one of the major problems. And when after a whole year in office, Obama admits to Time or Newsweek interviewer that, you know, my big disappointment is the Middle East. You know, I thought maybe I could... I thought maybe we'd get some progress in Arab Israel, and there hasn't been any progress at all. We just thought you can't influence these people. And I'm thinking, $3 billion a year out of your taxpayer money. $3 billion a year goes to Israel, okay? That's not leverage? So let's be aware of these things. It's just one factor, but it's one that's seldom mentioned and one that maybe people like Bob and I can uniquely mention because we're not running for anything. And because, well, I was going to say because we don't need money, but that wouldn't be true. Thanks very much.
Folks, if you'll line up at the mic there, we'll open her up for questions.
What we're sort of hoping for is to get a sense of what people are interested in. Oh, is your glasses? Okay. They look like my glasses, right? Don't feel at all shy. We're just looking, if you just want to say this is something we'd like to hear more about, that's what we're here for. Okay? All right.
You mentioned Ellsberg's personal risk when he exposed those papers. Curious if either of you have ever felt personal risk as a result of your stories and your activities?
Well, I wouldn't say that I felt the kind of personal risk that Dan Ellsberg encountered. I mean, Ellsberg had a real chance of going to prison. In fact, he was tried, and the only reason he got off was really that Nixon had gotten so crazy about possible additional disclosures from Ellsberg that he formed a group called the Plumbers, and they went into the Brookings Institution where they thought there might be some of Ellsberg documents. They went into his psychiatrist's office to get what they thought might be information they could use to discredit him. And only when the judge learned that, the judge said, this is not America, this is over the top. And of course the Plumbers then of course also became involved in spying on the Democrats and leading to Watergate. But so Ellsberg faced a certain kind of risk, and a physical risk, too, because the kind of extreme tensions that existed then. So he was a person who, and if people, it's worth seeing this documentary, because I did not fully understand that Ellsberg was a Marine. He was a very gung-ho Pentagon official. He was very much involved in creating the Vietnam War. He was one of the young planners for the war. And for him to have turned the way he did after seeing all the slaughter and the abuse was a pretty remarkable tale, and that it led him, as a man of conscience, to do what he did. But as far as we're concerned, as far as I'm concerned, most of what happens in Washington is not physical assassination, but character assassination or career assassination, and that you do have to deal with. When I was working at the Associated Press doing some of the original, the work that became Iran-Contra at some level, there were a lot of attacks against the work we did. We were called all kinds of names. And there was a group, there were groups both outside and inside the Reagan administration. There were groups that, like Accuracy in Media, Brent Pizzell had an organization. These are very well-funded operations. They get millions of dollars a year. And their job is to target individual reporters with attacks, personal smears, that kind of thing. There was also inside the Reagan administration, we now know based on documents that have come out, there was a very conscious effort to do what they called perception management. And perception management was an effort to manage how Americans perceive the world. It was sort of a Cy War kind of concept, something they might have seen directed against an enemy state. In another situation, in this case, it was being directed at us, at you and me and everyone in this country. And it was, how do you make people more afraid of the Central Americans? That was a big factor. How do you get them riled up about Nicaragua? So you had, and those campaigns were very upset when reporters like myself would dig up information that went against the propaganda themes. They had these propaganda ideas they were trying to sell to you, and if we were to say, hold it, that really doesn't add up, then they'd go to our bosses, they might go to your bureau chief, they might go to your editor, they might go to your publisher, and sort of say, can't you do something about this troublesome person? And surprisingly, that was effective in a lot of cases, not just, you know, situations that I was personally involved with, but others like at the New York Times and other major news organizations. Reporters were having their careers ruined for trying to dig out the truth and in ways that went against what the Reagan administration wanted as their story. So yeah, there was that kind of thing that went on, but I wouldn't say it was particularly a physical threat. It was more just you knew that you were putting your livelihood on the line all the time. And ultimately, I battled through it with AP. We got a lot of important stories, but there was always a lot of blood on the floor. There was always a lot of angry editors out there who sort of wished I would just go away. But we did get many of those stories out. When I went to Newsweek, I encountered even a more aggressive attitude among the Newsweek executives that they didn't see the American people as people who should be informed. It was sort of a weird thing. I remember having this conversation with one of the top executives saying, well, our job is to get the information to the American people. And I was told, well, no, Bob, that's not right. Our job at Newsweek is to guide the American people. And the thinking was that they would provide you the information that would lead you to what they considered the proper conclusion. And many of these folks had now moved more toward being neocons. You know, that's sort of it's a phrase that may have a lot of meanings to different people, but that's where they were going. And they were very much supportive of an aggressive American foreign policy. They were very big on maintaining the sort of imperial aspect of America with, you know, bases all over the world and America having great military power. And so if you came up with stories that went against that or raised doubts about it, those were not welcome. And so my battles there were mostly over trying to get to the bottom of the Iran-Contra scandal, exactly what had happened, how it had happened. And there was tremendous resistance. And so I was basically, I had so many fights, I had to leave. And, sorry.
Tell the story about the dinner party.
Well, you know, one of this goes back to, I was new at Newsweek. And I had grown up inside the Associated Press, which was a kind of more of a working man or woman's kind of organization. We call ourselves newsmen and newswomen. We didn't call ourselves correspondents or anything fancy. And you know, and AP was okay. I mean, it was very much just the facts, ma'am, kind of place. There was a certain timidity there, too, but it was basically honest. When I got to Newsweek, I was moving into a different stratum of how elite news media would look at the American public and its role in the country. And an example was that, you know, one of the first, when I was fairly new there, it was about March of 1987. So the Iran-Contra scandal had broken. There had been an initial investigation by something called the Tower Board. And on that was Brent Scowcroft, who was this very fairly serious guy. And they had basically said, well, you know, there wasn't much here. You know, Reagan may have been inattentive to details. And, you know, I thought it was a cover-up, and I was already reporting that this was a cover-up. Anyway, so we'd have these fan dinners every once in a while, and so the top brass from New York would come down to Washington. This one was at Bureau Chief Evan Thomas's house. He had a lovely house in Northwest Washington. And as one of the lowly correspondents, I was there. And so we'd sit around this dinner table, and there were two guests of honor that night. There was Brent Scowcroft was there, who'd just been with the Tower Board, and there was a congressman from Wyoming named Dick Cheney who was there. And Cheney was going to be the ranking Republican on the House Iran-Contra investigation. So it was kind of like the baton of the corrupt was being passed across the table. Anyway, so we were all sitting there having our salmon and asparagus and, you know, lovely sauce. And there was a starched waiter who was serving us and filling our wine glasses. And so at one point, Scowcroft says, I probably shouldn't say this, but if I were advising Admiral Poindexter, who had been Ronald Reagan's national security advisor, and if Poindexter had told the president about the diversion of profits from the Iran arms sales to the Contras, that was the center of the Iran-Contra scandal, Scowcroft said, I'd advise him to say that he hadn't. And so, you know, not knowing the etiquette of these affairs, I put down my fork, and I said, General, you're not suggesting that the admiral should commit perjury, are you? And there was like this embarrassed silence around the table. And finally, the executive editor, Maynard Parker, who was sitting to my left, booms out, Bob, sometimes we have to do what's good for the country. And there was a certain amount of manly guffawing around the table. And I realized I had really faux pas'd that one. It was hard to recover. But I mean, I think to answer your question, I think there is, the risk you feel, and sometimes these risks are almost worse than physical fear. You know, I've often been struck, not as much by, it's true of journalists too, that you'll go into the field, you go to war zones. I'm not a war correspondent, I basically was based in Washington, but I would be in Central America, and I'd be in Grenada during that. I was in Haiti during some of the mess there in the 90s. So, you know, there'd be times you put yourself in physical risk, and it never phases you in an odd way. It doesn't phase you. But then you go back to your home bureau, you get a nasty memo about your expense account or something, and you're suddenly shaking, you know. It's this odd phenomenon that you see often with people like in I had a DEA friend who was undercover in South America, and he would deal with the worst people. His life was on the line every second. It never fazed him, but then he'd go back to headquarters in Washington, and he'd get criticized by some bureaucrat, and he'd be like a puddle. And I was sort of wondering about that sort of phenomenon. But the answer to your question is, I think the fears are mostly that our careers would be cut short. And that's not, you know, your livelihood's taken away from you. Your standing with your community and your colleagues can be taken away from you. Those are very painful things. And just really one quick last story on this. There was a story that I did back in 85 with my colleague Brian Barger at AP on Contra drug trafficking. And we were just looking at sort of how are the Contras supporting themselves financially. We're following the money, as you might say. And we stumbled upon the fact that some of them had gotten involved in the drug trade, which I guess makes sense. There was drugs going through that area, and they would help reload the planes and so forth. And we reported that story for AP. It got a lot of attacks and criticism, as you might expect. But then you had, so the story kind of was followed up on by John Kerry, who did an investigation, and some was established, but there were a lot of attacks on Kerry. So it sort of ends up in that gray world of so many things, where you're not quite sure it's true, not sure it's false, you know. But it was then revived in 1996 by a reporter named Gary Webb for the San Jose Mercury News, and he reported on some of the problems that had occurred in especially African-American communities in the cities. And so that led to a lot of more interest, and the Black Caucus in Congress demanded an investigation. But oddly, the big newspapers, which had poo-pooed our story back in the 80s, went on the offensive and began attacking Webb. They found little flaws in his story. So the New York Times and the Washington Post and the LA Times just trashed him mercilessly. And that caused his editors back in San Jose to get nervous for their job. So they kind of sold him out, basically. And what happened next was really interesting, because the CIA did a credible investigation of itself. And the Inspector General, Frederick Hitz, came out with a report that said, yes, it's true. 50 or so Contra units were involved in drug trafficking. And, you know, we knew it. We knew it was going on from 1980 to 1990, the whole decade. And we covered it up. We suppressed investigations. We deceived Congress. They admitted it all. And the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the LA Times basically ignored the results. You know, at Consortium News, I thought when I get these reports, I'd say, wow, and I'd write this thing up, and I'd get it on the wire, I'd get it on the internet. And I expect the next day the New York Times will have a front page story. This never happened. It was not something they would deal with. So Gary Webb's career, he was sort of forced out at the San Jose Mercury News. He couldn't find work in his profession. Ultimately, his family broke up, and in December of 2004, he took out his father's gun and killed himself. So there are real consequences. This is not, but in terms of physical threat for journalists, I don't think that's a big deal. Sorry. That was a long way of answering the question. Do you want to add anything, Ray, or are you?
I was just wondering about a story that I heard like a while back or whatever involved the whole Georgian-Russian war that occurred during the 2008 Summer Olympics. That I had heard that there was journalists that had spotted like some of the airways there were being used to fuel transport planes that were supposed to drop troops off within Iran using American planes or whatever. I was just wondering if you all had ever heard anything about that.
This is the conflict in Georgia that occurred between Russia and Georgia?
Yeah, that apparently that the reason that we were supporting Georgia was because we needed them to or we needed some of their Air Force bases and whatnot?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not written on this, and I always sort of have different standards. There are certain standards where I say, well, I will write on something is because I'm pretty strongly confident about it. I have heard that there was that one of the reasons Georgia was so important to the West was that it has very close relations with Israel too, and that the Israelis had possible plans to use some of those Georgian airfields for if they needed if they did attack Iran and needed to have a place for their pilots to go without when they couldn't get back all the way, there might be some reason for emergency landings. And so those airfields are significant, partly because of Iran. But I haven't heard exactly what you mentioned. Maybe Ray has. I don't know.
I was also wondering something else about the whole missile shield thing within Europe. That for the longest time Russia was paranoid apparently that the missile shield was not aimed at Iran or at any of these other nations, but rather at their airspace. And I'd heard that the president of Iran or whatever had made a comment about that too pretty recently, saying that it was never aimed at Iran but rather aimed at Russia.
Why not? Go ahead.
You're referring to the corporate welfare program that's called the anti-missile program, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. More billions of dollars have been wasted on an unworkable system than anyone's conscience can justify. It's been sold to the American people as a project that could work, but at each pass it could easily be defeated by rudimentary countermeasures. So, yeah, when I used to watch the Soviet Union pretty closely. They're neuralgic for historical reasons about missiles in Western Europe that could hit them, and worse still in Eastern Europe. So the only solace they took from that was the fact that they knew that they could institute countermeasures. But when you're that close, you can't be sure. So Obama had the good sense to sort of cease and desist on that one. And the Iranians, the Iranians don't have any capability to get to Europe anyhow. So it was all just a corporate welfare scheme to keep funding billions and billions of dollars to what General Eisenhower called the military industrial, and now we can add congressional media complex. Folks, that's serious. Military industrial congressional media complex is about as close as you can get to fascism.
So what you're saying
and
is that
I don't use that word easily. Please.
So what you're saying is that it wasn't aimed at any particular country. It's just
theoretically, they could justify by saying when Iran gets missiles that could have a nuclear weapon on top of it. Now, for 25 years, the intelligence community has come up with one consistent conclusion: Iran could get a nuclear-tipped missile within the next 5 years. You follow me? So 20 years ago we said that, 15 years ago, 10 years ago. We're saying it now. I mean, you'd think they'd be a little embarrassed, huh? Okay, sorry. Next question.
My point is that those kinds of things can be used against any of the countries. I mean, Russia has certain reason to be concerned, but so do other countries if they're afraid that that neutralizes their missile capacity. They see it as an offensive potential threat.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you all.
Welcome.
My question has to do with is the election of President Obama helped? Your comment, Mr. McGovern, a while ago, saying he didn't realize he had $3 billion worth of leverage is a little depressing, but now your more recent comment on the missile defense shield is encouraging. And Mr. Obama did make the Cairo speech, and he did, I gather, send General Jones to the J Street meeting. So have things really started to turn around or not, is my question.
Well, Bob and I were talking about this in the ride down. It's one thing to be terribly disappointed in Obama's achievements so far, And it's another thing to say that he's just as bad as his predecessor. My God. Yeah. So, you know, the anti-missile thing is one good thing. The professed desire to stop torture and close Guantanamo, that's another good thing. And Bob and I are in a general agreement that Obama would like to act otherwise. I guess where we disagree is that it seems to me that that doesn't matter so much. It matters in some way, but if he's going to cave in to the Israel lobby, if he's going to cave in to the military-industrial complex, he's going to cave in to the Republicans who are thwarting the ability of us to get decent health care. You know, I don't know how much it matters to me that his heart's in the right place. He's caving in at every turn. And the real danger here with respect to Iran is that, you know, you have Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, looking at this president who I'm convinced Netanyahu considers a wuss, okay? Here's our president saying, no more settlements in the occupied territories. Illegal. And here's Netanyahu. We'll be building 20 next week, and I'm planting trees in the next bunch of... I mean, you know, it's really pretty embarrassing. And then Obama saying, well, you know, I thought maybe I could... Well, you know, I think on that he might have been a little naive, but look who he's got around him. Rahm Emanuel and that crew. Dennis Ross, he inherited some of the worst of the neocons and some of the worst of the other folks. So I just don't have them figured out. But, and I can say right off the bat that I'm disappointed, but you know, it's always a matter of compared to what. And when I think of a McCain Palin ticket, yeah, thanks. Please.
I want to make a comment before I ask my question.
Sure.
So, my comment is taking what you've said to 2010. What we've experienced in my campaign is that every time you try to go to clubs or organizations or even to some news outlets to tell why you're differing from your opponent, you're told that you cannot go into these clubs because we don't allow politics. Or you're told that we don't support one candidate over another, so therefore you can't get any press release. So this is an important issue. We have 6 pundits for every journalist in America. We have now closed down the opportunity for people to really know their candidates because we're relating it always just to money and the ads you can buy.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Americans are losing their choice. We're going to lose our democratic republic over this because people don't have a voice. They don't have a choice. And I just wonder how we're going to resolve it. We certainly can't resolve it just by encouraging people to use the Internet because in West Virginia, the main source of information is Fox News. There was a study done, mm-hmm. and that's the truth of the matter. So I'm really wondering how are we going to get, you know, people to be able to make intelligent choices when they elect officials? Mm-hmm. I don't know the answer. I'm trying all this grassroots and going to the groups and being told, well, you can't come in because we don't do politics.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real problem. So what's your solution?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how many people?
Probably much rather.
Well, you know, I guess one thing I'm always afraid of when I speak or when we speak is that I don't want people to be totally depressed. But and there are lots of reasons to be depressed. There's no question there are. I would be lying if I said otherwise. But there are also reasons that there are hopeful signs. There are things that groups like this, people getting together to hear things. But I would agree with you 100%. I never felt that starting our internet site was going to solve that many problems. I was never that naive about it. And in fact, I find the internet in many ways kind of annoying. There's a lot of junk there too. We try to maintain strong journalistic standards with our material, but a lot of folks don't. And so even the internet can be a source of tremendous misinformation and confusion, and we've all read some of that stuff. And then you have the failure of the mainstream press to do its job as we might have thought back in the 70s, some of us who were around in that time frame. So the idea of having the watchdog there is now gone. Then politicians have found themselves needing more and more money to run because they're getting attacked in a 30-second commercial. They need to be able to hit back with their 30-second commercial. Makes them more and more dependent on rich people and ways to getting money together. I must say that, you know, in Capitol Hill, I know many politicians who hate raising money. They hate it. I mean, they don't know what else to do. And actually, the group that we spoke in front of a group in Santa Monica the other day, and there were people there who had raised a lot of money especially for Obama and the Democratic candidates in particular, and they were totally demoralized too. I mean, they were feeling that all they'd done was sort of a waste, and that they weren't sure where things were headed. So okay, that sounds depressing, but. But I do think that you also have some chances to do what you can, and I've always approached journalism that way. That you know, if we all sort of try to do our part, if we all can do what we're supposed to do as citizens, or in journalism, or teachers, or politicians, or what have you, things can improve. You know, I really do believe that. I used to when I was a journalist at AP, I remember there was my first marriage, my first wife's grandfather who had fought in World War I, and he lived in Wells, Maine. I don't know if you know Wells, Maine, but he'd sort of get his cane and he'd walk down to the local 7-Eleven and he'd buy a copy of the Boston Globe and he'd bring it back and he'd get his magnifying glass out and he'd read the paper. And I always thought that when I was doing stories, I owed that kind of person, that kind of American, the best I could do so they would, if they went through all that trouble, and it could be that or it can be more just going on the internet or buying a newspaper in a stand, people are owed the best you can do for them in that regard, and they should want to trust you, and they should be able to trust you. So I think the idea of rebuilding that trust, which we're seeing in some cases, is important. I also think that this is where Ray and I differ a bit on Obama, and I don't know Obama personally. I've never met him. I have been in his presence when he's spoken. Obviously, he's a great speaker. He's a very intelligent man, and that is, I guess, that is certainly maybe an improvement. But I also think that it's really up to us more than him. Now, yes, he's president. He can do a lot more than the rest of us probably can do, sort of individually, maybe even as a group collectively. But it's not just about him. He is just a politician at one level. And he has made mistakes. And he has made misjudgments. And maybe he's done them because he looked out and he saw that the forces of the media, the forces of the Republicans, or how the country was responding. He might have said, well, I think this is the best. I can cut a deal here. I can maybe... So I'll let Baucus talk to the Republicans all summer, you know, on health care, which led to nothing but just caused more trouble. But he might have been thinking that he had to do those things. And I think if we, as a citizenry, create a different environment, a healthier environment, and we take that responsibility on ourselves in any way we can, then I think politicians might have a better chance of doing the right thing. You know, I've often felt that, yeah, there are heroes in the world, but not everyone can be a hero. I mean, a lot of us have families, we have mortgages to pay, and you want us to, and sort of people just, what you want to be able to say is, you don't have to be a hero, you just have to just do your job, and you'll be okay. And if enough of us feel we can do our job and we'll be okay, then I think things can improve. But we can't pick everyone to sort of go, you know, jump on grenades and I guess I would say, and I think Ray might disagree a little bit with this, is I think it's really kind of up to us in a much more profound way to solve the problems and create the climate that lets the politicians act to their better selves. And I think some do, and I think maybe Obama's one of them. Ray's going to disagree with me now. He's going to say,
no, I want to agree with you. No, I think it really is up to us. I mean, how many times has Obama said, make do it? You know, just like Franklin Roosevelt said, let me do it. So how do we do it? Well, you know, I think we have to do more than we've done before. Number one, we have to change our mindset. You know, there's this peculiar American outlook or attitude that, you know, you don't want to appear foolish. You know, don't want anybody to ridicule you. And so unless there's something that has a reasonable prospect of success, you don't want to try it, you know. One of my favorite parts of Les Miserables, you know, where Victor Hugo is describing the bishop in this diocese who is really had no political instincts. He was so much not a comer that he couldn't even get priests working in his diocese. And then Hugo permits himself an editorial comment. He says, ah, yes, success. Success is an ugly term. Because all too frequently, people confuse it with merit. Well, probably the only person in the world that thinks that's significant. But we confuse success with merit. And there's lots of meritorious things we can do if we can just get out of our mind the notion that unless it's successful, it's not meritorious. The good is worth doing because it is good. And if it takes us now what Martin Luther King suggested we do, namely that sometimes you have to put your body into it, that's what we're going to have to do. I've got eight grandchildren now. I'm incredibly concerned about what kind of country they are going to inherit. And so when Cindy Sheehan calls us to the Capitol in the middle of March, I'm going to be there. If we need to march around, I'm going to be. If we need to go into our senators or our representatives' offices and not leave, I'll be arrested again. I think that it's come to that. And as Bob said, not everybody can do that, you know. One thing that's different about me and the reason why, you know, I'm not really a target of anything, well, I get targeted every now and then, but, you know, I don't need a lot of things. I've got a government pension. I worked for, you know, 27 years for the CIA, and I retired early, but the pension is much slower, but it's there, you know. Now, that gives me a freedom. I've got my first mortgage is paid off, and I wish to hell I wasn't able to get the second and the third mortgage, you know. But, you know, if to the degree that you're free to do things, then I think your conscience should say, well, you know, even though this might not be successful, it's worth doing because it's good. And the last thing I'll say on that is that in our little ethos there at the Ecumenical Church of the Savior, where I work in Washington, what we suggest and the way we've given rise to 10 separate nonprofits in the inner city is you get together with 3 or 4, 5 tops, close friends, people that you really identify with, people that you admire, people that admire you, and you get together, and you do that every week. Now, what does that do? Well, that creates a kind of bond, a kind of possibility of discussion that will give rise to ideas that none of us would individually be able to come to. And not only that, when you get a good idea, whether it's visiting your congressperson's place or whether it's doing something more civil disobedience type, then you have support, you know. Then you have accountability. If we agree to do this, well, we're going to do it, right? Okay? So 6 is okay, 7 is too many, but if you convene in these little small groups and get together every week and discuss these really important issues, and let's face it, these are really important, more important than any time during my 70 years. Oh, thanks for being shocked that I'm 7 years old. Yeah, these are really important things. So what we need to do is attack them in a more intelligent way, get together in small groups, and then not be impeded by the notion that, gee, if we're not successful, then people are going to laugh at us. That's okay. People have laughed at all kinds of people, and then other people have won.
Good Good evening. Well, first I want to thank both of you for coming, and Ray, for you coming back. I just want to say that I am a long-standing fan of consortiumnews.com. Read it regularly, have for maybe 4 or 5 years now. But I wanted to bring up a point that you made in Mr. Perry made in his answer to the first question. And he brought up the whole issue of perception management. About the time that it started going in the 80s, really the 70s, I mean, from what I've investigated. And we've had, especially a place like here, like West Virginia, which is very limited in the sources of information people can acquire, we have been barraged by the forces and the vested interests of perception management for 30 years and longer. I mean, you know, you talk about the Internet. I understand that just this week they're going to try and do something about it. But just this week, but we're now ranked 49th in the country in terms of broadband availability. Where do people go for their information? Well, you may have a good idea. I certainly know. Those presets on the AM dials in their cars. And it's incessant here in West Virginia. It's incessant. You know, hours and hours and hours a day. Now, what I'm wondering is, and I know where this originally came from, and the sort of people who are behind it. And I can even, you know, I can name names. I think a lot of people here in this room can. But what I'm wondering is, after 30 years, have we reached something of a threshold? Has the Coke industries out west, who've been behind a lot of, you know, I really hesitate to call it information, but more entertainment type ventures, yeah, that have that people have been listening to incessantly here for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Have we reached a threshold now where they're funding an organization that's headed by Dick Armey, mm-hmm, which is essentially headed up or arrived at the Tea Party movement?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Have we reached a threshold here where perception management is such that it feeds people's idea of worldview, not necessarily, you know, little bits, mm-hmm, maybe there's some truth to it,
yeah,
but only little bits of selective truth here and there.
Good.
That feeds their worldview. Mm-hmm. And that all that people want after these 30, 35 years is just to be fed information that conforms to their worldview. Mm-hmm. They don't want real information.
Yeah.
I mean, has it really got to that point?
Well, Bob is our expert on perception management, so.
Well, I hope it's not that bad, but I mean, I certainly understand what you're saying. My sister, I shouldn't tell personal stories, but you'll just keep it among ourselves here. My sister's a wonderful woman. She's a PhD. She studied under Skinner in Chicago, and she's a psychologist. And she was what I guess Limbaugh would have called a feminazi at one point. And then she moved back to Massachusetts and was living with my parents. She had a long commute to Waltham, where she was working at a hospital, mental hospital, and she would listen to the radio. And she'd listen to Rush Limbaugh, because it was kind of, I guess, entertaining or something. And after a while, she became a feminazi for Limbaugh. It was kind of the strangest darn thing I've ever seen. So I know what you're talking about. People, even who are real smart, who should know better, you might think, get pulled in. I think there's a lot of effectiveness there. But I think here's the core. I think, well, first of all, if you go back to that period of the 70s that you mentioned, the American people were sort of out of control. We were out of control. We were no longer, we would not go along with the Vietnam War. That was a big change. Americans had, the whole post-World War II consensus was shattered because people thought, and thought correctly, as it turned out, that the Vietnam War was a huge mistake, and we were sending young men to die for something that wasn't worth it, and we were killing a lot of Vietnamese who really didn't deserve to die. So there was a shattering of that consensus, and that consensus had to be put back together for the people in charge of the country to function. And this was thought through. And one of the most interesting things to me was, as we go through the 80s, we were sort of brought back in like we're dipping our toes into cold water and getting more acclimated back to it. There was like Grenada, which was this sort of silly little invasion of an island that makes nutmeg. And then we did that very well. And so then we later on did Panama. And that then led to the first really big step back, which was the Persian Gulf War in 1990-91. And this is interesting because the Persian Gulf War was, of course, Saddam Hussein, for various reasons, went into Kuwait, and George H.W. Bush vowed to drive him out. Now so we began bombing, essentially, just bombing the heck out of the Iraqi forces. And they were quite badly beaten. Their command and control was destroyed. And then the question became, we'd moved 500,000 American troops there, should there be a ground offensive? And President Gorbachev of the Soviet Union had sort of had struck a deal saying, okay, the Iraqis will leave Kuwait, they'll leave behind their big weapons, we'll stop the slaughter. And interestingly, the people who agreed with this were people like General Schwarzkopf and the commanders in the field, because they didn't want to send their troops to possibly die and face chemical weapons and the rest of it if they didn't have to. So Schwarzkopf then he's in Saudi Arabia, he calls Colin Powell, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and says, could we, we don't need to go have this ground war. We can just get what we want, get them out of Kuwait, free Kuwait, and enough killing, Schwarzkopf said. And Powell kind of agreed. So he goes over to the White House, and he gets to the White House, and President Bush is pacing back and forth. He's concerned about this Gorbachev initiative. He said, we don't want to look like we're really screwing Gorbachev, but we have to have our ground war. We have to have the ground war. So Colin Powell raises his hand, and Bush calls on him, Colin, and Powell says, well, we could give them like one day to withdraw. How about that? One day to withdraw. And Bush says, that's a great idea. It'll sound like we're actually doing something that Gorbachev wants, but we know that they can't possibly withdraw, and we will have our ground war. So Bush goes off and onto the White House lawn, announces this deadline. Schwarzkopf and his commanders back in Saudi Arabia are watching, and they say, it means we're going to war. They knew what it meant. So then there's 100 hour of slaughter. Basically, the Iraqis, mostly draftees at this point, most of their smart guys, the higher ranking people, had gotten out. So we just basically butchered maybe 100,000 or so. We never really got the count very good of these Iraqis who were fleeing. After the 100 hours, George H.W. Bush goes down to make a comment, and his first comments are, we've kicked the Vietnam syndrome once and for all. Which is kind of a remarkable statement, but it explains what it was all about. They wanted to reestablish the consensus behind war. And they did. If you remember, after that, there were tanks that were put on the Washington Mall so your kid could go play on a tank. They had ticker tape parades for Schwarzkopf and Powell down Broadway. They had fireworks displays, and we all felt great about war again. And it was a very important moment because that now brought us back and sort of reestablished that consensus that war was a good thing. It was even kind of fun, frankly, because we could see the green lights, and we could have like the almost like video games. We could watch things blow up, and it was kind of cool. So that was part of the perception management. That was really the goal of perception management. They had to manage our perceptions to get us back to a point where we bought in again to this consensus. And it has continued, that consensus has continued onward, clearly up to the present. It was shaken a bit by the second Iraq war and how badly that was going. But it still remains a powerful consensus. And along with that was built this huge media apparatus where literally tens of billions of dollars have been poured into this thing. And it started, it's worth sort of going back really quickly through this, that after the Watergate, after the problems with the Dan Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers and all that, and the scandals about the CIA, there were people who got together, and a key person was Bill Simon, the former Treasury Secretary under Nixon, and he was head of the Olin Foundation, and he pulled together Smith Richardson, Scaife, some of the Koch brothers you mentioned are getting involved, and so they start investing their money in media. Because they think information is going to be the key, or we might call it misinformation or disinformation, but they think that's the key, information. And so they invest heavily in this. Strangely, the progressive side sort of is pulling away from that at this point. there'd been a very lively underground press in the around Vietnam. There were newspapers and radio stations and magazines like Ramparts and Dispatch News, which where Cy Hirsch was working. And those all get shut down or phased out or sold off. Even something like the New Republic, which was a venerable liberal publication for many, many years, is sold to Marty Peretz, a neoconservative. So the New Republic becomes the incubator for Charlie Krauthammer and Fred Barnes and these neocon right-wingers. So, and this sort of, this builds and builds. Reverend Sung Myung Moon, you know, this crazy Korean theocrat, he shows up with millions and millions, ultimately billions of dollars to set up a newspaper in Washington called the Washington Times. And he's funding a lot of conservative operations beyond that. So you had, and then, of course, Murdoch shows up, the Australian guy shows up, and he starts pouring money and becomes Fox News. So you had, so this is not, this was a really well-orchestrated, well-organized effort that spanned decades. And we're living with it. And it does, it has the power you're talking about. And it's a point I've made too, is that it's maybe if you're living in certain cities, if you're in New York City or maybe LA or something, you will get a certain variety of news. If you're living in Kansas, or you're living, I guess, in West Virginia, as you say, there's a lot less. And what is there is this propaganda, constant propaganda. And that's why I have argued that information is so crucial to solving our problems, because only by information is like the lifeblood of democracy. A well-informed population can act. A disinformed or confused population will not be able to act. So if you empower people with information, that's a really important thing. And the last thing I would say about this is that another key point of all this, it goes to the Tea Party crowd, in effect. One thing that was at the center of this whole idea was that the American people had to be convinced through kind of a populist message that the government is the problem. And that was the message that Ronald Reagan conveyed. If you remember his first inaugural address, he says, government is the problem. It is not the solution. It is the problem. And he sold that to a lot of people. And then he proceeded to bust the unions, you know, PATCO and so forth, and a whole bunch of other things he did. Then the neoliberals did their thing with foreign trade, or basically a lot of our middle-class jobs were sent overseas. But the key point here is that the idea was to convince enough Americans that the government was the problem, not the corporations. So corporations would sort of quietly fund these populist movement, and the point of the populist movement would be get the government out of our lives. But the only way that corporations that are so powerful now can be countered is with an energized, democratized federal government, because only the federal government has the power to check them. So otherwise, we're left on our own. And it happens to all of us. It happened to me just last week, you know, when my health insurance was jacked up 25%. So I'm supposed to negotiate with my health insurance company? I mean, they don't care. I can say, well, I'm taking my business elsewhere, but no one else, then the next place charges me the same or close to it. So if the federal government is not working on your behalf, then you are left vulnerable to everything from your health care to, you know, your cable TV bill. Try to work with the cable TV companies. I mean, they have all these schemes or your bank. Just all these things, unless there's some way for us as collectively through our democratic government to check this, we're victims. And so what the genius of this is to convince these people who have almost nothing. These are not rich people. These are, these people, they think they're standing up for freedom. And what they're standing up for is corporate dominance of America and of their own lives. So.
I agree with everything you say.
Okay.
I'm right with you. But what are you going to do if you bring people the facts, you give information, and people say, I'm sorry, yeah, you're wrong?
No.
That's exactly what we're facing. You can tell me whatever you want. I so agree with you. I'm right where you are. Politically and philosophically, but Fabio said, no. Even if you present the facts, they say no.
Well,
you're wrong. You're wrong, and you can't teach these people.
Well, I agree. No. That's fine. This is what the whole idea of this is. I think Americans really don't like to be fooled. We don't like to be snookered. Now, that doesn't mean we don't get snookered. That happens a lot. But we don't like to be snookered. And I think if people could understand, if that message could get through that, you know, these corporations are funding through various channels these grassroots organizations that are very populist, and turning you against the only hope we have of checking the corporations, I think that's a rather simple message in a way, and one that maybe people would say, you know, there's a point there. Now, obviously, any kind of education of a population like America that has been so disinformed for so long, where a lot of the institutions, including mine, journalism, have failed miserably, it's a very steep climb, and I would not ever pretend otherwise. All I'm saying is I think that's the message that I would, you know, in a situation like that, I'd say, well, okay, so you're successful. You shut down the federal government. Then what? Let's say you had the federal government as some, like, some of the right wing have suggested is, you know, have it so small you can drown it in a bathtub. Okay. What's that? Yeah, Grover Norquist's line. You know, shrink it to such a size like a baby. And, you know, I mean, sort of an awful image or metaphor. But okay, you can drown the government in the bathtub. Well, then what? Okay, so you have your freedom, but freedom to basically have corporations dictate everything in your life, including whether you have a job or not, or whether you have health care or not. I mean, I think people would, I think they might get that. Okay, maybe they wouldn't. But anyway. I hope that, does that respond to your question? Okay.
The gentleman, I've waited a good long while right here.
Please.
I almost forgot what my question is.
Speak right into the mic, please.
I hope everybody's listening, because you've really touched on some very good points. But I want to ask you, if they took the nuclear equation out of the Iran debate discussion altogether, do you think that we would not still be wanting to go in and attack Iran ever since Khomeini overthrew the Shah, whom we were well pleased with, as we are with every monarch in the Middle East and throughout the world? Although we preach democracy, we're in bed with every monarch, which goes against the founding fathers who went around the world preaching revolution and overthrow a monarch. But if we took the nuclear question out of it, do you think they would still not be wanting to attack Iran?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And the question really is, who's they, right? I'm sorry?
That's right.
Yeah. So let me just go back a little bit. After the war, when I say the war, my generation, that's the Second World War, there was a very prominent diplomat, one of my idols, actually, George Kennan, ambassador of the Soviet Union. He headed up the policy planning staff at the State Department. He wrote a memo, the first one, and he said, look, we, the United States, comprise only 1/9 the population of the world, but we control 50% of the world's natural resources. So let's be aware of that, and let's realize that our foreign policy has to be designed to make sure that we keep that advantage. And we can't be distracted by human rights type things or other non-political realities. Our policy needs to be made to ensure that we keep 50%, more than our share, of the natural resources of the world. Now, I didn't learn that until I was in graduate school. It was a real downer for me, because being a Russian specialist, I really admired Kennan. And he, of course, grew in the years. But, you know, if you look at things, in the Middle East, and you see the history, and you see what happened early on in the 70s when Henry Kissinger, under a pseudonym, wrote an article in Foreign Affairs, not Foreign Affairs, another journal, saying we should just send the military in and take over the oil fields in the Middle East. And he sent that around to his ambassadors in the Middle East who knew something about the Middle East. And the fellow in Saudi Arabia, Atkins, wrote back and said, this person obviously doesn't know anything about the Middle East. This is crazy. It's never going to work. Then he learned it was his boss, Kissinger, that when he was Secretary of State as well as National Security Advisor. So that's the idea. Now, oil is a very important factor, no less important than Israel. Okay, what about oil? Well, we'll see what happens in Iraq, but that was one of the objectives, okay? There were three objectives. Oil, okay, to make that part of the world safer for Israel. Now, don't laugh. I mean, it couldn't be less safe for Israel now. Didn't work out that way, but that was one of the objectives. And the other one was what I call permanent military bases. Pentagon now says enduring military base. Okay, so it's the same with respect to Iran and Afghanistan. Now, when people try to figure out why are we doing what we're doing in Afghanistan, well, part of the reason is that we need oil and natural gas to maintain this disparity, our way of life. Okay, and people don't know that Turkmenistan, that sits right on top of Afghanistan, has natural gas deposits that are worth more than oil under Iraq, okay? And that there's a pipeline, the engineering studies for which have been done, that goes right through Afghanistan, Pakistan, down through a little slice of India. You know who's going to own the terminal of that? A company called what? Enron. Well, Enron was going to take this stuff at the end, but Chevron is already in there. You're right. They're pumping the oil, or they're trying to explore the gas, but you can't get there from here, or you can't get here from there. That's what I'm trying to say. So that's part of the rationale. Besides, of course, it's a very strategic area. And, you know, the whole mindset is we have to control it to get what we need. And there's a certain logic there, because if you want 50% and you're only, well, less than 1/9% of the world, okay, then, you know, China, Soviet Union, now China and India need this stuff far more than we do. And so, you know, if you're playing this imperial game, you're going to lose in the long run. And when I was helping my youngest grandson's teacher in the nursery school, 4 years old, these kids, after it was all over, I said, what do you hope to teach these kids? You know, what can you teach 4 years old? And she said, oh, that's very easy. She says, we teach them that they need to share things. And I go, Bush and Cheney never went to this nursery school. There's a certain number of blocks on the table. You know, rather than have a fight, you have to share things. And it's really basically that simple. So if we got together with the Indians and the Chinese and the rest of that immediate area, plus the West Europeans, said, look, there's a certain amount of gas and oil deposits in this part of the world. Let's be sensible. Let's figure out ways to share it equitably. But we don't want that, because we still want our 50%. And the last thing I'll say on this score is very, I think, revealing. I was giving a talk in Pewaukee, Wisconsin. Anybody know where Pewaukee, Wisconsin is? Well, it's a very, very affluent suburb of Milwaukee, okay? So I'm talking about these things, and after it's over, this young man, very well healed, 35-ish, comes up to me, and he says, Mr. McGovern, what is your problem? I mean, would you tell me, what is your problem? And I said, sir? And there were about 30 people gathered there to ask more questions after the main lecture. And I said, what do you mean? He says, well, you don't doubt that we need the oil, do you? I said, of course not. I mean, that was half of my lecture, talked about the requirement for oil. He says, well, then you have to admit that 3 or 4 GIs killed every week is a very small price to pay for the oil that we need. He said it, folks. He said it just like that. And I'm looking around at these other 29 people, hoping to find somebody that would go, but they're all just kind of looking at how McGovern's going to answer this question. And so I thought quick. I said, well, maybe the utilitarian answer would help you. I said, my problem is they're not going to let us do it. The Iraqis are not going to let us steal their oil. Okay, that's my reason. Ah, oh, Mr. McGovern, have you not heard? We're the sole remaining superpower in the world. You know, they can object, but we'll still. I said, okay, well, suppose one of those kids killed last year was your son. He looked at me and said, it would be my son. And that's the problem, folks. It wouldn't be his son. You know? Most of the people, more than 50% of the people in our armed forces are from cities or towns, really, less than 50,000 people and the inner city, okay? And then I got kind of angry, and I said,
they're disproportionately.
Is that right? Yeah, that's right, yeah. So then I said, well, are you one of those people who like to have the Ten Commandments introduced into the schools and the courthouses? Oh, yeah, I think that would be a good idea. I said, well, you know, I think I remember one that says, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's oil, goods. There's one about stealing. There's one about lying. There's one about killing people. And then there's also one about thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, as if God could be on our side in this god-awful war. He looked at me. Yeah, well, I said, yeah, so maybe you just track those five and you put five commandments in. You turn around at his heel, whisked out to his, you know, SUV, gunned it, and boom, was out of the parking lot, you know. But that's the mindset. Maybe just subliminally, maybe just the unconscious of people. But we got it pretty good. What would it mean if we lost in Iraq or lost in Afghanistan? Would that mean $5 a gallon, $6 a gallon, $7? Well, you know, we have to come to our senses and realize that our place in the world is not, you know, deserving of even more credit, as Kennan thought it was, than China or the Soviet Union or India. Yeah.
I take what you're saying, that we need the oil, so we're going to get it.
Well,
I don't think we're
going to get it out of Iraq.
Now, you say that's one of the reasons we went into Iraq, and another reason was to protect Israel.
Yeah, well, that's clear from those documents.
That prompts the next question.
Yeah, sure.
What price are we willing to pay for Israel security?
Well,
we've got to. We can't get on an airplane. We can't. You see the billions and billions of dollars that it's costing this country, plus the lives that are being lost.
Yeah. Well, what's going to be really interesting.
Why do we side with a country of 3 million, 4 million people and alienate 300 million people in an area from the Persian Gulf to the Atlantic Ocean with a policy, a foreign policy that we have? Is a balance of power, they call it.
Mm-hmm.
That is, we are to keep 4 million people stronger militarily than 300 million people.
Mm-hmm.
And they live in a state like Rhode Island. That is like saying if a superpower like Russia armed Cuba to the extent that they could dominate us, how would we feel?
Yeah, we wouldn't feel very good about that. It's a very good point, and it needs to be addressed, but I think we ought to...
Okay, yeah, let's move on. The two gentlemen that are there, and that I think we've got to close about 9, so let's have these two gentlemen be the last questions.
Make it an easy one.
I'll try. I do think it's fairly simple. I'd like to start with a comment about something you guys addressed earlier, which was... us taking responsibility rather than relying on the government for absolutely everything like we always do. Something we all learned when we were very, very small was that democracy means government for the people, by the people. It's the last part that most people forget is by the people. Because, yeah, for the people, sure. Yeah, we rely on them to do things for us. But what we don't realize is that we can do things by ourselves. The question I wanted to ask was, if you have the information, you know, we've talked about, you know, getting as much real information out there as we possibly can. If you have the information, I don't know, how many of you know Judge Duke Bloom? I mean, any of you? Okay. So I've had a few experiences with Judge Duke Bloom. About a particular case involving my mentally retired uncle who has been unjustly put in a mental institute. And when you find information, incriminating information, about people who are doing things like what Judge Duke Bloom has done, like Bobby Miller, who works for these for a mental hospital, and
you got a question,
a couple of attorneys
that we might be able to answer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Don't worry about it. And it is, if you have information like that, incriminating information, how do you project it?
Mm-hmm.
How do you get other people to listen to you? How do you, when the newspapers aren't paying attention, when the news channels aren't paying attention, how do you get it out there?
Mm-hmm.
Huh? Well, it can be very hard. It's obviously you've got to, you know, on a practical sense, I don't know, I'm not familiar with all the newspapers in this area or what the TV stations do. I think, though, you do have to bring together as much of the detail and as dispassionately as you can and present it to and try to get someone interested, try to get a reporter for a local station or a paper interested in some specific case like that. I mean, I don't know the details. Obviously, these things can be kind of complicated. We've all had situations where elderly relatives have had troubles, and sometimes I think they do get unfairly placed in situations where they're deemed to have dementia, or they're deemed to have problems of that sort, and it's very hard to get out of it. I mean, I ran into this case with an old Iranian source who had his wife had him committed, and you know, and it's almost like worse than being in prison because you have almost fewer rights than when you're in prison. So I understand what you're saying. I think though the key for you if you're trying to get some attention on this is to first of all get the material together, have it be with some, if you have some authority, some doctor or something who would be on your uncle's side, then maybe you can get someone interested. These are painful, hard stories though, because they all vary individually, and it's tricky to get a reporter interested because it may just be too complicated for anyone to really spend a lot of time on it. But you know, I sympathize with you, and I hope that sort of advice might be of some help.
A quick example of managed perception, and I'm a veteran, and it saddened me when they changed Armistice Day to Veterans Day. How sad! But anyhow, there are two major crises, the crises of in the world, I think. Global warming and the economic crisis that hit the world capitalist system last year. Briefly, what sort of hope or despair would those two crises offer our situation in this country that you described?
Well, I think to some degree, this gets to the point of, can we have a democratized government? The young man was talking about government by the people. And it doesn't just mean that we should do things by ourselves, because in fact, in many cases, you can't address big problems by yourself. We all know that. But if a government is democratized, that is, if it actually is representing the people of the country in a meaningful way, and there is a problem with that because so many of our politicians are dependent on corporate donations themselves, but let's assume for a second we could get a system where more and more of our politicians we actually cared about what we wanted and what we needed and what our country needed than what some donor or some corporate donor might want. I think then these kinds of problems would get addressed. I spent time covering the securities regulation area for Bloomberg News for 4 years. I was editing their material on it from 2000 to 2004. And what we saw was an assault, really, on regulation. Because part of this part of the myth is that, well, all regulation is bad. It's easy to say, oh, get the government red tape out of the way. We're going to, you know, markets will regulate themselves. That was a myth that was sold to many of us. And we see what happens. You know, if the government is asleep at the switch, or is worse than that, is complicit in these kinds of things, we end up with corporations and big banks. Those guys were making money hand over fist. I used to like deal with some of their 10-Ks and their filings they had with the SEC. It was obscene to read this stuff. It was obscene. I mean, these guys weren't that much smarter than the rest of us. Do they really deserve, you know, $10 million, $20 million compensation? How could they even face themselves? I guess it was pretty easy because you're probably in St. Bart's or someplace and you're just having bought your new Ferrari. But we let that, the government let that happen out of these misguided concepts that were sold to the broad American public to a great extent. Now, so we have to understand why that's a mistake. on something like global warming or climate change, similarly, we have to both, first of all, make sure that the evidence is as good as we can get it, and I think is presented well. And there's been a lot of effort to sort of confuse things there by certain missteps getting focused on. But I think if the public can come together and say, this is something we have to do for our kids, then I think we can make some changes. You know, I guess, and sometimes there's a journalist side in me which may be the much more discouraged. Because as a journalist, I'm not quite sure if I can really tell people that things are going to get much better. The grandfather in me has no choice but to sort of think, how can we make things better? Because this is our watch. And frankly, so far, we've done a pretty bad job on our watch. So I think that's why I feel we all have a commitment or a need to sort of a mandate even, an imperative to do whatever we can to make it. And that's why, you know, when I left, I quit Bloomberg. I had a six-figure job. I had great benefits. And I went back to try to, you know, get the website, you know, more of a daily kind of thing. My wife wasn't really thrilled that I left a good-paying job with great benefits, but you know, I kind of felt that this one couldn't just walk away and say, I can take care of myself, because we all have to, in a sense, take care of each other, and we all have responsibilities to each other. And I think that, and that's the grandfather in me talking, and maybe, you know, I don't know which is going to prevail, but I sort of would like to see the grandfather side have greater success than the cynical reporter side.
Well, we are pulling for the grandfather.
Okay.
Thank the gentleman for coming, please. Great evening, guys. Thank you so much. Lovely. We would like to remind you also, Seneca 2, if you'll fill out the evaluation form, we'd appreciate it. And if you would like to partner with us in some kindred spirit and effort, please leave us your contact information. We'd be delighted. Thank you for coming, and good night. Also, folks, if you'd be interested in a Seneca 2 print, we'd love to sell you one over here to the left.
And so that concludes tonight's Seneca 2 Forum, live from the campus of West Virginia State University in Institute, West Virginia. I certainly hope you have enjoyed the presentation by Robert Perry and Ray McGovern, consortiumnews.com. What you had an opportunity to hear this evening was, at least in my humble opinion, what a real journalist sounds like. And God knows that sound has become as rare in this country as the call of the ivory-billed woodpecker in some Arkansas swamp. We need more of them. We need a lot more of them. And so I'm grateful that this gathering of good progressive liberal folks here in the Kanawha Valley of West Virginia were able to hear what they had to say. And perhaps if one in ten of them goes and writes a letter to the editor about the failure of media in this country, if one in ten gets after their local newspaper, their local, if it bleeds, it leads, television news departments, then perhaps the tide begins to change. I want to thank everybody who helped make this possible. Thanks for the input. Sorry about the video breaking up and falling out along the way. This was, after all, one of those situations where the newly laid keel is slid into the ocean to see if the sucker will sink or float. And I'd say I'm pretty pleased because, for the most part, it floated. We got the video out there. We got a lot of good audio out there, and it's only going to get better from here. Now, this is very, very exciting, this next step that the Horn is taking. So with it being 5 minutes past 9 p.m. here in the Eastern Standard Time Zone, we're going to knock off and start packing up to head back up the mountain. Snowstorm coming this way, and we want to get home and not miss it. I want to thank Horn intern junior grade Ferg for his help in producing the program this evening.
You're welcome.
Yeah, okay, thank you, Ferg. And I want to thank my lovely and talented wife, Agnes, for her efforts as well. A special thanks go out to our friends at Seneca 2. They have facilitated many of these wonderful discussions, and I look forward to the next one, whomever it may be, hopefully in a very few months' time. Thanks, of course, go out to all of you. None of this happens without you. Gasoline costs money. Transit costs money for us to get here and do this. And the fact, you heard what Robert Perry had to say about the state of media in this country. The Horn exists because you have decided that you are not satisfied with the state of media in this country, and you want something different, and we are doing everything in our power to deliver it to you. So thanks to you who contribute to keep the Horn going. Thank you sincerely from the bottom of all of our hearts. And, of course, none of this would have come off tonight without the help of technical people and talent people and amazing people who keep this keep all the plates spinning in the air. That includes Peter Godbold, John Fox, Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org, our good friend Michael Kid A, that's how he's known to you in the chat room, has been of inestimable help in sorting out video issues to make this first effort even possible. Thanks go out to our moderators in the chat room, Sue and Lottie, to Sue for her help in just stream checking and all the brilliant work she does. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan, to our blogger, Texas Betsy, to my head writer, David in Tennessee, and to our Southeast correspondent, Matt Osborne of Osborne, Inc., INK.com. Thanks little dry work here. Thanks also go out to the bravest, hardest working people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. They are the hardest working, bravest people I know. They prove it every day. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.